Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified. This is the opportunity for you, the audience, to pick up the phone, call us that question that's been keeping you up late at night. And today in studio with me is Carl Jepson with the Carl Jepson Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck. It always sounds funny.
I know. When I say that, it just doesn't roll off like it used to.
Technically, it's not a firm. I mean, because there's just me. But
well, you got a staff.
Yeah, I got a staff.
Yeah,
I
do. Okay.
Yeah, well, one.
You know, well, listen, there's a lot of things going on in the economy, and as all of our listeners know, if you have a question, today we have an honored guest, Rodney Johnson, co-editor, co-partner, I guess you could say, of Harry Dent Research, one of the main cogs in the wheel there at Harry Dent Research, and a guy that I have enjoyed immensely listening to giving presentations on the economy year after year, and Rodney just seems to be getting better like a fine wine. So, Rodney, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chuck, and I appreciate that. Getting better like a fine wine. That's pretty awesome.
Doesn't that sound good?
Sounds great, particularly since I'm turning 50 this year, so I'm feeling like a fine wine.
Hey, don't worry about it. The wheels don't fall off till about 63.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Well, you're talking to the old guys today. So we don't have Kevin in studio with us.
So with Jepson, because he's by himself apparently at work every day. So
well, that way the pace is easier. You know, I can take naps and stuff.
You know, you remember Rodney Dangerfield?
Yep.
Well, there you go.
Yep.
Well, Rodney, there's a lot going on, and we haven't had a chance to talk to you or Harry for about a month now. But you know, when the economic report and the unemployment report came out, I thought that was going to be like a boomerang effect, but it actually had no effect at all.
Well, it sort of did. I mean, clearly everyone looked up and said, "Hey, wait a second! The last jobs report was 38,000 jobs created when the modest consensus estimate was 160,000 jobs for May." And first of all, there was a Verizon strike in there, which took 37,000 out. But even with that, it would have been 75. And so kind of the big picture is, wow, wait a second, it's slow. And while the stock market didn't fall dramatically based on that, and you didn't see blood in the streets on the investment side, the Federal Reserve sure took it to heart. And they came out, of course, this past week and said, we're not raising interest rates, which they had said at every single speech that each of the governors had given for the previous 6 weeks. It's coming, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And so for them to change their view based on literally one data point, to me, it speaks to what they don't know. And here we are in the most important financial economy on the planet, and the most important group within that economy being the central bank and the Federal Reserve, and they're basing their decisions on data point after data point, and they go, oh, yeah, this one's bad, let's not. It just... How much less confidence can we have in this system when that's how they're making decisions? It's just amazing to me.
Well, I got to tell you, for our listeners out there, you know, this is a live show. Rodney's talking to us live from somewhere in Florida, unidentifiable location, but I'm sure you are in Florida, aren't you?
I am, and Tampa's pretty findable. I'm here on the coast in Tampa, Florida.
Okay, but if our listeners want to pick up the phone and call and ask Rodney a question, you can call toll-free 877-733-1011. That's toll-free from anywhere in the country, and I say that because we have a broad listening base on podcasts, and we've done over a million emails advertising the fact that you were going to be on the air with us. So hopefully maybe we'll get some calls from some outlying areas, not just the Great Northwest, but all you people in the Great Northwest, don't hesitate picking up the phone, giving us a call, and asking a question, because this is your chance to talk to Dent Research directly and ask them a question about the economy. And absolutely, we should all be concerned about the economy, shouldn't we, Rodney?
Oh, absolutely. And go back to the Fed for a moment, not to pick on them, but they're certainly the highest profile group out there. Their forecast back in 2012, their forecast for 2016 economic growth was over 4%. And their forecast in 2013 was 3.5%. And their forecast, in 2014, maybe 3%. Now they're saying we'll be lucky to get just at 2%. And so what this tells you is the people who are clearly in charge of this is not a, gee, they have some authority, or gee, they kind of vote on policy. These are people who have taken on the mantle of those who direct economic growth in the United States through changing interest rates and monetary policy. They don't know how to do this. They do not know what levers to pull to change this. And we've been stuck in this exceptionally low growth environment for more than half a decade. And everybody's scratching their head going, I don't know. And if they don't know, how in the world are we supposed to know? That's the big problem. And yet we have to make the investment decisions to get us from A to B, from our working life to our retirement life, in this low growth, uncertain environment.
I would think they would get a standing ovation if they got 2% growth.
Well, that's just it. And that statement in itself should make everybody go, wait a second. We printed $4 trillion and held interest rates at zero for 8 years, and all we got was 2%? This is crazy. It begs the counterfactual, of course, which is what would have happened without it. I don't know. No one can know. I can estimate what would happen. It would have been a much worse downturn in 2009, 10, and 11, but the recovery would have been much stronger from the lower, more solid base. But we can't know. All we can do is go from here. And that's what we're going to do. And I wish that they would take on a more steady pace of change instead of this, we'll tell you when we get there if something possibly might happen at some date in the future that we haven't decided yet. That's a terrible way to run monetary policy.
Isn't our country like the guy who has a whole bunch of credit cards? They're all maxed out. He's barely making the money every single month to pay his minimum payment, and his debt just keeps piling up and up and up. And he's living in the delusional world that he's going to inherit money, or he's going to hit the lottery on Wednesday afternoon, and he's going to be able to pay off all his credit cards. Doesn't that sum up the federal government?
Well, it does, in as much as we're not making any headway in paying off debt, and we're not even holding it steady. Because it does grow every year. But where the analogy breaks is, if I'm an individual and people are loaning me money and I'm taking on more and more and more, one day someone's going to look at me and go, you're not a very good credit risk. And they're going to stop because there are other people they can loan to who are a better risk. There are other business lines they can take. The strange world we find ourselves in is that the United States government is the top of the financial heap when it comes to currency. And so people are dying to lend us money. I mean, clearly with interest rates so incredibly low and long-term interest rates around 2.4% last week on the 30-year Treasury, I mean, who would have imagined that we could take on this much debt, be over 100% debt to GDP, and yet people are willing to lend us money for 30 years at less than 2.5%? It just boggles the mind.
Well, we're the best of the worst.
We're the best of the bad guys. The high yield of the developed world, strangely enough.
Yeah.
What, are you taking lessons from Yogi Berra or what?
Well, Carl was asking me before the show, Carl was telling me, and I was out of town all week, and so I just got back late last night. But so I haven't been able to check up on all my email and see what great things you guys are putting out there in the email world, because I get them from you guys daily. And Carl was telling me that that Harry had put out a thing about, what was it, six reasons
why...
This is
Rodney.
Rodney.
The seven startling reasons why the Donald may become president. And I
got to tell you, that was Harry Dent. That wasn't me.
So that was Harry. Yeah. Okay. But I really like, and that was a little stark in a way. You know, it was kind of like, wow, how depressing. But the reasons. But I really liked your email about Texas putting their own gold depository together. And yep. I just thought that was a really interesting, you know, kind of thing that they who knows, maybe they're going to have another Alamo here someday, who knows, but I thought it was great.
You know, Texas, for those who weren't following this story, Texas bought thousands of ounces of gold 4 or 5 years ago, and they paid around $1,450 an ounce, so they still are underwater. Ooh. On that investment. But they're not going to get rid of it anytime soon. They'll hold it not for a year or two or five. They'll hold it for 20, 30 years. But they immediately found, of course, once you buy it, you have to put it somewhere. And it's not like you put it in a basement or a closet. And so they're holding it in the depository in New York that goes through the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And they're not impressed with that. They would rather do it locally, meaning in Texas. And so they're building a gold depository in Texas to house their own gold. But they're opening it up to everyone who wants to put a deposit there, gold or cash. You can use it kind of like a bank. It won't be a bank in that it does fractional reserve. They won't lend out more than they have, but they will take deposit and allow money transfer. And so it's kind of the first step to a gold-based bank in the United States. And leave it to a state like Texas to make that happen, right?
Oh, absolutely. It could be an oil bank.
Only in America, yeah.
Texas, of course, is, like you said, has probably more more of a state identity than just about any other state in the country.
Of course, I live in Florida, and tourists come to Florida as they go to lots of places, and they'll buy a shirt or something, and they go home. But as I noted in the piece, no one in Florida that I'm aware of that lives here every day has a T-shirt that says Florida. They just don't. And they'll have a T-shirt from their college, be it here or, you know, afar, but they don't have one that's just the state of Florida. And I lived in Texas for 15 years, and my wife is from Texas. Every person I know had a T-shirt that said Texas, and they would wear it from time to time. And it's one of those identity things that you just don't find much of anywhere else. It's very strange.
Yeah, you don't mess with Texas.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you say that, but I was just in Texas for about a week and in San Antonio, and then drove down to Laredo. And mm-hmm. I got to tell you, about every car had a sign on it, "Don't mess with Texas." I mean, it was like, whoa. Flashback time, I guess. But
that's kind of a funny thing. That "Don't mess with Texas." People think of it as Texans looking at the rest of the world saying, "Hey, man, watch out for us." The origins of that is that it was an anti-littering campaign aimed at Texans who were throwing stuff out of their car on the side of the road. But it took on this persona of, hey, we're in, you know, what they are, Texans, independent, cowboys, libertarians, whatever you want. But it's very interesting that "Don't mess with Texas" came from littering in their own state and became this, hey, this is who we are, let's be inclusive, which I find hilarious.
But well, anyway. I'll tell you one thing I will say about Texas. And I mentioned this on the show before, I think their highway system, I think they have one of the better on and off ramp systems in the country for getting on the freeway and getting off the freeway, because we have areas here in the Northwest that I swear to God, the engineer that designed it had no idea that he was merging traffic together to go into two different directions going into one other place. And that just doesn't work always.
No, it is. We lived in Dallas, which had some terrible issues there in the center of the city on what's called Central Expressway, and it was exactly the same problem. Everybody looked at it as basically the world's worst place for rear-ending other cars. Redesigned it and built a much more intelligent system for entering and exiting the freeway without as much propensity for accident.
Well, I can tell you, we had a great stay in Texas, and in spite of the fact everybody there was very, very nice, even though we were Northerner outsiders.
You're Northwesterners. That's very different from Northerners.
Well,
Northerners,
that's true. We at least are from the left coast, although they didn't really like hearing you're from California, Oregon, or Washington.
Yeah, they're suspect, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But we had a great visit there, and of course, it's hard to not like the weather down there.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You got to Laredo. That can be pretty darn hot.
It was. It was very hot, but that's what swimming pools are for, that and air conditioning. Well, listen, Rodney, I got to ask you about the economy. You know, Harry's been saying for some time we've been looking at all the graphs of where this thing's going. And it just looks like to me right now, most Americans are uncertain of their future. They're uncertain of the economic future. They're looking at this thing. And I think that's why a lot of people, maybe the big boys are moving money around, but most of the average investor is kind of holding their breath and just hoping that we're going to turn this thing around.
Well, and isn't that interesting, Chuck, because is it that they're uncertain or they kind of have a confident view of what's coming? They just don't like it. And I'll tell you that the people that I talk to, investors that are, you know, clearly planning their financial future and putting money away, they don't see a path to where the economy grows, like we said before, 3-4%, which would lead to companies doing much better in profit, which would lead to companies' stock prices moving up at, you know, 7-10% a year. And so they look at the economy and go, I don't see where we're going to get that type of opportunity. Therefore, what seems most likely is that we either remain flat or down. And those are two real bad choices when you're investing. And so, unfortunately, the confidence is in the very muted view of growth or a decline, which is the exact story we're getting from the Federal Reserve, from the International Monetary Fund, and from basically every other authority saying, guess what? This is not going to grow well. Therefore, you should be somewhat cautious. And it leads to that thing of, I don't see long-term, 10, 15 years, where this gets a lot better so that the people come after me have even more opportunity. And that's where it gets very, disappointing, is because I look at my kids. My youngest goes to college in August. The oldest just graduated. And what is their financial future? And they're on the right path, you know, college educated, of course, and going to college, which puts them in a different league, but it's still not the best league. The best league was 25, 30 years ago when we were coming through the system and we had all that growth in front of us. It's hard to see the future engine for growth.
You know, I feel exactly the way about only is it, I'm not worried about all my kids. All my kids are in good positions and doing really good, but I really worry about my grandkids. And I've got a granddaughter who's got a year left in college, and mm-hmm. I am real concerned about the market she's going to walk into.
Great. And you should be, because as we talk about all this, that's what they're going to have to deal with. And we know that those who start their working life in a down economy don't recover that wage growth even 20 years later. Their wages do grow, but they don't have the same growth as somebody who starts in an up economy. And so we're in a very divergent economy or dispersed economy in terms of income, meaning a lot of people's incomes are not growing while a few are growing dramatically. And it's really hard to get yourself into those small spots. And it was energy for a while. It's not anymore. It has been high tech, but it's a very thin slice of the economy where that's working. Now we're seeing some wage growth, but it's at the very low end. And so, yeah, you can have your income go up by 9%, but you have to make $8 an hour for that to happen. That's not a very good trade.
Well, yeah, in Oregon, you don't have to worry about that because we're going to have probably the highest minimum wage of any state in the country coming by 2020. So,
and probably the lowest number of minimum wage employees, too. Because on the flip side of that, of course, is do I keep three cashiers that are now making $15 an hour instead of $9? Or do I automate two out of three and have a kiosk that costs me $35,000 a year but cheaper than an employee, certainly by year two? Never takes a lunch break, never calls in sick, never has an issue. I don't have to worry about harassment from this person. They're never going to treat an employee bad. And guess what? I just keep the one person who makes a little more and can make it all go.
Well, you know, that it is scary, and I think the biggest problem is most of our politicians at the government, at the local level, the state level, and the federal level, never ever worked at a regular job or had to actually pay a payroll, and they have no clue what it takes to make a business run. They have no clue at all. And I look at this thing, what they're setting us up for, and I feel really bad for my grandkids, because I think the next 20, 30 years, the sad news is, like we said, we're the best of the worst. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other countries. I mean, two weeks ago, Germany went negative on their interest rates.
Right, on their 10-year bonds, they're actually negative.
Yeah. What would happen in America? What's going to happen? Well, let me say it the other way. What's going to happen in America when we go negative on our 10-year?
It's going to be strange. And the pain there is investors, of course. And it's not – we always talk about investors, and certainly it's the main point of a program like this, is to talk to the individual investor about what's going to happen in their situation. But if we step up a little bit – from, you know, me personally, you personally, or the listeners personally working on their own situation, say, well, what about those who are handling institutional retirement, meaning pension funds? Well, guess what? If we get to negative rates on the 10-year or even sub 1%, there's no way for these pension funds to make the money they need to pay their liabilities, to pay all the retirees. And that situation is already underwater, and the numbers are too big to make any sense to anyone. They don't to me. I mean, we're underfunded by at least $1 trillion in pensions across the United States, which tend to be in states, meaning the public employees. As interest rates go lower, that underfunding gets worse, and that comes back to us in the form of taxes, because one day they're going to show up and say, guess what, we want our money, and the states are going to say, gee, we don't have it. And who is going to look at the retiree and say, yeah, you don't really get it. This has already played out in Detroit, and guess what? They got the money. It's about to play out in Puerto Rico, and it's coming to a city, county, or state near you sometime in the next 5 years.
Well, so, I think it's already here.
You know, they're already.
Well, I mean, we're having there's an interesting thing that there was a Supreme Court case that went we had an attempted fix on the public retirement service here in Oregon, and they basically tried to do certain kind of adjustments to make it so that it might, you know, be a little bit more solvent. And the employees union filed lawsuits, and ultimately the Supreme Court of Oregon determined that no, you know, we had an agreement. There was a contract, a binding contract between the employees and the state, and they got to pay them what they got to pay them. Period. And so that means that there's a lot of places where, particularly, you know, counties and cities where they don't have much of a tax base, they're running to the point where they have all these unfunded, you know, retirement payments that they have to make, and so the only thing they can do is kind of like cut people out of the current workforce. So they're, you know, and they're, you know, cutting out police officers and firemen and all that kind of stuff. Of course, I think they always kind of start there. I never hear them about saying, well, let's see, we're getting broke, and we ought to fire all the building officials or the planning department people or the public
driver
development people.
Zero.
Rodney, we got a question from a caller here, and this is great to get a chance to have you interact with our live audience. So we've got a question from a caller here. I don't see a name on it, but TJ. TJ, are you there?
Yes.
And you got a question?
My question is, my wages have been pretty stagnant about the last 5 years or so, but the cost of college goes up roughly 10% a year. You know, and I got a 12-year-old growing up. So my question is there a point where you don't get the return on investment on college? You know, for example, in my field, you know, I make roughly, $100,000 a year, but I get, you know, student interns coming in, and they owe $250,000 coming out of college. I mean, I would think they're in not very good shape for, you know, a lot of years. So, I mean, so basically that's my question. Is there a point where college doesn't have a return on its investment?
Yeah, and TJ, the answer is absolutely. But it's a very, very narrow place where that doesn't happen. And if most every study you're going to see based on college and does it pay for itself is going to say, yes, of course it does. Because if we look at people's earnings over 20, 30 years, then they earn over $1 million more than somebody that didn't go to college. And so the investment clearly pays for itself. The problem is they're including the working years of course, the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s in their study. A much better question is, does such a large investment in college today, will it pay off going forward for somebody's working life? And the answer is yes, depending on what you study and how much debt you take on. And that, not to evade the question, but to put a finer point on it, if someone is taking on a lot of college debt, and I actually just did a video about this this week, they're typically going into professional services. They're going to be a lawyer. They're going to be a doctor. Those are the places where the median amount of debt is $140,000 and $160,000 of student loan debt. People who get just an undergraduate degree, their median amount, or 50% or above, 50% or below, is around $20,000 of student loan debt. And so to get a college degree and have $20,000, $30,000 in student loan debt, certainly a doable thing and a smart thing, because the unemployment rate for college graduates 10 years out of college is just under 3%, just under 3%. Now, not all of them are in professions that require a college degree, but guess what? That includes police officers and firemen. You don't need a college degree to do that, even though many people in those fields do have a college degree and they're well paid. And so I would say, yes, it does, but you have to keep a close tab on the expectations of your 12-year-old, where they want to go and what they want to study. And I've just gone through this with all three of my children. We had the wherewithal to send them to private universities if they wanted to go there, but we sat down with each one and said, look at what you're getting and what you want to do. One of them is in an engineering field, very technical, but she went to Georgia Technical Institute, a great school, not MIT, of course, not Cal Poly, but a fabulous school that costs less. And so what I think is happening is people are pursuing college degrees, but with a much closer eye on how much it costs. The people who are really in trouble are those who went through college 2008, 9, 10, and 11. They were still in the la-la land of go to the school with the big name, no matter what the cost, and just, you know, darn the torpedoes. And they're finding out, wow, $150,000 in student loans for undergraduate degree was a really bad idea.
All right. Thank you for the answer.
Yeah, I think Rodney, I think the whole thing is it's time that parents sit down with their kids, just like you did, and have a strategy.
Setting that expectation early. Exactly, Chuck. And I don't know if TJ's still with us, but starting at 12 is what a great time to start pointing out to a young person what their expectation is versus what's reality of what can be afforded and what the gulf is in between, so that when they get to that junior year and they're starting to look at colleges, they're clear-eyed about it. Doesn't mean they don't apply to Dartmouth or Harvard or Yale or I went to Georgetown. Go to Georgetown if it's got a program that's so specific for you and it fits fabulously. But if not, don't go just for the name. Not worth the money.
You know, Rodney, years ago we tried to put together a financial planning course for schools to take on, and they wouldn't do it because the financial planners are always trying to get into the schools, and with the school unions and everything, you have to be careful what you can do and what you can't do. But right. One of the things we proposed years and years ago, and I have to say the school system is a little bit against this kind of thing, but we thought that, hey, if a kid goes to high school for 4 years, why shouldn't they have to manage a checkbook for 4 years, learn the fundamentals of spending money and making money and actually handling your money, and actually have to have a balanced checkbook each year to go to the next grade? But doesn't that make sense? Because half the people in this country don't
back from the next grade, but they have to do this on the side to prove that they understand debits and credits.
Yes.
I took accounting in high school. I don't know why everyone doesn't.
Yeah, I think it ought to be mandatory. I did too. I think it ought to be mandatory. I can't believe in our country we don't require people to get the necessary fundamental education that you have to have to survive financially. So
yeah, there's a long reason why that is, and I know it's not the point of this radio show, but education is woefully lacking these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Rodney, we appreciate it. I do want to ask you a quick question here, and I'm going to give a shameless plug here for Dent Research, because it's something that I use all the time, and I refer a lot of people to them. But the Irrational Economic Summit is coming up October 20th to 22nd. I've got my tickets. I'm ready. And it's going to be held at the PGA National Resort, Palm Beach, Florida. Is there any exciting surprise gifts that you can tell us about?
It's not surprise, but exciting certainly. David Walker is coming, who was the Comptroller of the United States, who was ringing the bell back in 2007-08 about the United States being broke and the state of our debt. And that's back when we only had, you know, $5-6 trillion in debt, and now we're of course closing in on $19 trillion. So he's going to be our featured speaker, and somebody that most people probably haven't heard of, but I interviewed him yesterday, a gentleman named Raul Paul, who's a global macro investor. He works out of the Cayman Islands, and he's kind of a broad look around the world at what's going on and how money is flowing based on business cycle. And his view is that we are staring right at a recession in 2016 in the United States, and that interest rates will go to zero, if not negative, and, you know, clearly just have a lot of hurdles. Unlike us, he thinks gold is a very positive place to be over the next couple of years. Could be right. And so he's somebody that most people probably don't get an opportunity to hear as individual investors, and he's going to be one of our featured speakers as well.
Well, you know, one of the things I like to plug about Harry Dent and about you and about Dent Research, you guys have no qualms about bringing in guest speakers who have a contrarian point of view to yours.
I
know Harry gets a lot of flack from people about his, you know, predictions and stuff, because Harry is a little bit flamboyant. Just a little. Yeah, just a little. and I'll tell you what, he's even more so live than he is on TV. But
yeah, he's calmed down for television.
Yeah, he's calmed down for television. But I got to say it, it is always great to go to these because you hear both sides of the story.
Right. And particularly, you know, most people that come to our conference are going to have a dim view or certainly a modest view of economic growth. That's not a function of us choosing people who meet our expectation. It's a function of the world moving to our view. Because, as I said, even the central bank and the IMF say that things are going to be pretty modest and downright dim for years. But on things like gold and the U.S. dollar, where we thought gold was going lower and the dollar going higher for many years now, certainly we'll bring in people who have an opposing view because we want to hear it. We want to fight that one out with a good, solid debate so that investors get both sides and can say, hey, okay, now I can weigh the positives and negatives and make a good decision.
Well, I don't know how far this is from me. I haven't seen any things about it being sold out or anything yet. But any of our listeners who manage their own money, who have the financial means, and if your financial advisor isn't going to get this kind of education, then you need to ask them why not. Because I know I go there and I meet financial advisors from all over the country, and a lot of us keep in touch, you know, all the time. And we just wouldn't miss one of the Irrational Economic Summits.
Well, I appreciate the plug because we're certainly going to have a good time. I know we are closing in on a couple hundred people already. And as you say, I mean, this event is 4 months away. And so as we get closer, I fully expect it to sell out. So if people are considering it, I would recommend that they make their reservations early.
Well, I have to honestly say I've been to every one of them but one. And I got to tell you, everyone's been better than the one I went to before. And the one we had last year in Vancouver was an unbelievable meeting.
Yeah, that was great.
Oh, it was
a great meeting, and I can only hope this one even tops that.
Yeah, well, Harry was in his prime at that one. Well, listen, Rodney, thank you very much for taking part of your Saturday with us, and I will be talking to you guys soon, and looking forward to seeing you in October.
Thank you both. Have a good day.
Thanks, Rodney. You bet. We're going to take a quick break on Investing Simplified. And again, you can sign up for Rodney and Harry's free economic report. You can do so on my website or at dentresearch.com. If you got a question, pick up the phone, give us a call. Carl and I are here. We're going to come back with Carl's comments at give us a call at 503-417-9595. Toll free 877-733-1011. And a special thanks to TJ for calling in and asking Rodney a question. That was great, TJ. We appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Remember where you've been? That's the way I see it. I'm a simple man.
Hi, I'm Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and co-host of the radio program Investing Simplified. I recently left the Warren Allen Law Firm to open my own office. Professional and personable service have always been the hallmarks of my practice. I believe that this move will allow me to spend more time with my clients. For more than 37 years, it has been my privilege to assist clients with practical estate planning with wills, trusts, powers of attorney, advance directives, and other documents so that they may have peace of mind knowing that their affairs are in order. When probate becomes necessary, emotions of family members may become fragile. Having an experienced attorney that can empathize with what the client is going through makes the process much easier. My new office is conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, just across from Mall 205, and my phone number is 971-229-0585. That's 971-229-0585.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepsen.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. It's always a challenge to follow either Harry Dent or Rodney Johnson, but we'll do our best here. And we have Carl's comments coming, but we want to make sure that we answer any calls that are coming in. And one of the things that comes up in my practice all the time is, you know, how do you avoid probate? And we've talked about a lot of those kinds of things. And I just wanted to run quickly through some of the methodologies that can be used for this purpose. First and foremost is the living trust, which is, you know, is a more comprehensive tool to avoid probate. But there are all sorts of things that can be done also. So if you don't want quite that much, one is to make sure that all of your financial accounts have what we call pay on death or beneficiary designations. That's one thing. Another is to have joint accounts. There are some pluses and minuses with all of these particular things. And then there's always giving stuff away before you die, which is also a good thing, maybe. I came across an interesting statute here a while back that's another kind of – I wouldn't call it a tool, but so much I would call it as just a sort of a safety valve in a way. And that is we found that there's a statute that allows you to have to access a bank account that is in a decedent's name if you have a certain relationship to the decedent, and the decedent dies and leaves the bank account, and that all of his bank accounts that are left that are not, you know, designated as beneficiaries or anything are less than $25,000, then by preparing a particular form of affidavit, the bank can give them the money, and it's not the best thing for everybody. But the reason it came up was one of my banker friends sent some people over, and they had a small bank account, but they didn't want to go through a probate, and they didn't want to go through a small estate affidavit, which is another way of doing it, because all of those things involve, you know, some money to spend, and in this case they would have spent more than they would have got. So I researched this statute and found that and prepared them an affidavit. So they went back and I didn't feel comfortable because the amount of money was really small about charging them any money. So I said, you know, you got to bring us a, you know, a, a Starbucks gift card for doing it, and they did, and they were really happy. But it's just another tool that you might think about if you happen to be in the position of being a relative of a decedent, and you find out that there's everything else is taken care of, and no probate is necessary, but you find this one little bank account that's under $25,000, and this is one way to do it without spending a whole bunch of money. And although I'm not guaranteeing that I'm going to work for Starbucks cards forever, but but nonetheless, it just seemed like the right thing to do. So that's one thing. But and then the other comment that I had was, it's not at all unusual to have people who have a will and they become dissatisfied with it during their life, and they start tinkering. They start making little notes on it. They start Xing stuff out. And oftentimes they do it on the original will. Probably not the best idea. However, it's done. And then, sometimes what they're doing is that's what they really want to do. That's what they really intend to do. They really want to make this change. They really want to revoke this will. They want to revoke part of the will. They want to, do something with it. And sometimes that was a real problem because wills have a certain set of requirements in terms of how they have to be executed, and changes to the will are supposed to be executed in the same way, having two witnesses and done in the presence, and there's a bunch of the witnesses and the witnesses signing off on it, and so a lot of people just don't really want to get around to doing that, especially older folks, and so they make these little notes. Well, there is a way to use that will even the way it is. In fact, it would allow what we used to call a holographic will, even a handwritten thing, but it's a little bit more challenging than you would hope. And mostly what it would require is that you give, the writing, whatever it is, cocktail napkin or, paper towel or whatever. And, it has to, that you're intending as this will, it has to either be intended as the decedent's will. It has to be a partial or complete revocation of a decedent's will, or it must be an addition or an alteration, and you have to prove it in court by, clear and convincing evidence. So and that's a very high standard, by the way. There's preponderance and there's beyond reasonable doubt, and clear and convincing is kind of
Carl,
in between those.
What about the couple that sits down at the breakfast table? Writes up their last will and testament. They both sign it. They have a neighbor come over, witness their signatures, and say, if something happens to the two of us, we want everything to go to Susie or whoever, or their daughter or something, and just does that kind of a hand thing and has people sign it.
And if you could prove that that was what was intended, then it actually works. But it's a little bit challenging, and it's more likely to give rise to mischief. There's the what we would call post-mortem planning, which in other words, this is the Smothers Brothers thing. Mom loved you better, and we get this all of the time. During the administration of a will or a trust or whatever, and you get these calls from shirt-tail relatives that say, "Well, Aunt Bessie told me that I was going to get the the Rolls Royce or the 1967 Cobra." Of course, we all know that the lawyer gets the Cobra, but regardless of what's written down there, but the they're having to prove that. But so and I can see this gives room for mischief in terms of forgeries. People mom told them that they were supposed to get this, that, and the other thing, or that's what they believe they should get, even if they. Their memory is a little faulty about whether it was really told to them, and they kind of make it up and tear up the old will, and they say, "But I got this one. Here's this. I wrote this down here, and I found it. I found it in the family Bible, and it's in it's in Mom's handwriting. Anyway,
it's funny you say that because in the Bible, there's a lot of stories about families that had a favorite son or a favorite daughter or That's kind of been going on since time began, isn't it?
The one that gets shorted doesn't really like it very much, and sometimes they fight about it. But anyway, it is possible, but it's not a good idea. It's always good to have your will done properly and or whatever. I can see this, you know, you wouldn't want to plan this way. It's just one of those things that happens. And I think what happened was that the statute came about just and was changed just recently so that it allows a little more liberal approach to being able to prove this. But it's still a real uphill battle to prove because, you know, clear and convincing standard is very difficult, and that's going to be an expensive process because you're going to have essentially a court case involved on it.
So, well, you know, Carl, one of the things you and I have discussed a lot, and actually, unfortunately, we've seen it play out a lot. And I constantly tell clients something that you've said to me a long, long time ago when we started working together many years ago, and you said it's a lot less expensive to do it right the first time than to clean it up the second time.
Oh, it is. You know, I find it much harder to fix stuff that's been, and a lot of times what I do, a lot of times people come in and they want to have an addition to or a modification of their trust or something like that. And sometimes it really is easier for me to just start over and do it from the beginning rather than try to tinker with somebody else's work. And the reason for that partly is because I don't necessarily follow the same thinking that person does. And so you have to then spend a lot more time understanding the existing work and then making it work the way you want it to. And a lot of times it's just much more efficient just to do it over and make sure you get what you want.
Well, listen, if you got a question out there for Carl or myself about investing, pick up the phone, give us a call at 503-417-9595, toll free 877-733-1011. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Investing Simplified. We've got a caller on the line. Greg has a question about gold, and we're going to get to him right after the break. So if you're concerned about gold or want to talk about gold, listen closely because Greg's got a question about it. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com. 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question answered now. Call Chuck or Carl at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Chuck Price and Carl Jepsen.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is the time with the show where we usually do the Knowledge Trust. Kevin's off vacationing this week, and good for him to kind of take a relaxing weekend. And by the way, I do want to say, Carl and all our listeners out there, happy Father's Day tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to a day spent with my kids and enjoying Father's Day. So I'm looking forward to it. And I get to see a lot of my grandkids I don't get to see every day. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I don't have any grandkids. So, but I'm looking. But I got my big dog, you know, and he treats me like a dad, you know. So.
Well, there you go. Well, listen, I just want to say to all the listeners out there, happy Father's Day. Have a great day. And we're going to get to Greg on the phone. Greg's got a question about gold. And Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, well, thank you very much for holding through the time there. You have a question about Harry Dent's prediction on gold.
Yes, I do. I've been a follower of many years of, you know, the resource sector. And of course, I'm also familiar with Harry Dent, who who is basing his predictions on demographics, and I find that the gold bugs and the gold and Harry Dent predictions actually all fall into place almost until you hit the gold prediction. And I just wondered how that jives since his last irrational. What's the name of that?
The Irrational Economic Summit.
Yeah, the Irrational Economic Summit in Vancouver. I've seen gold, you know, some of these mining stocks have quintupled, for Pete's sakes, but they were way, way, way low. So I just wondered if this must be a blimp in his view, and how he jives all that with, as you guys are already talked about, the world sort of a chaotic economic picture out there, how that all jives in.
Does kind of all jive into the worldwide recession, mm-hmm. hopefully short of a depression that we go into, and we will be going into it. But here's the thing. It's interesting you say that, because I hope you've been listening to our show. But in May, I announced Harry's latest book. And Harry's latest book is How to Survive and Thrive in the Great Gold Bust Ahead.
Yeah.
And you can get that on Amazon. And I'd highly recommend anybody who is a gold investor to read that book and take a look at it. Because Harry, you know, I'm certainly not Harry Dent. And I'm just speaking from a financial advisor standpoint. And we've been telling our clients for years, and I've been following Harry since the 90s, we've been telling our clients for years, you know, we don't recommend more than 3-5% in precious metals. Now, a lot of people have 40-50% of their portfolio in precious metals. That's okay, but boy, you better have enough other money outside to survive when you need money, because it's pretty hard to sell a product that you can't move.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't eat it. So, you know, there's going to be times when gold becomes almost a useless commodity, because you can't sell it, you can't eat it, it's dropped in value. Then what do? You just got to hang on and write it back up. That's why we tell people 3-5% of your portfolio in precious metals is the max we recommend. And, in all the financial planning courses I've taken, all the financial planning meetings I've been at, that's generally the discussion, talks about 3-5% precious metals. But Harry's predicting that, you know, that gold by 2020 is going to be less than $300 an ounce.
Wow.
Now, the on the other side of it, in Harry's book, he talks about by 2040, it's going to be up to almost $5,000 an ounce. So, if you got grandkids like I do, some gold doesn't hurt to set that aside and leave that on out there for the next 30 years for those kids to inherit it. They're going to be at the peak of the market, where we might be at the bottom of the market. Isn't it always better to buy low and sell high?
Yeah, it sure beats the heck out of the reverse, that's for sure.
Yeah, and most investors do the opposite. So I would tell people, and I've been telling people on our show for years, I think the greatest buying opportunity in my lifetime for gold, for stock, for real estate is coming. It's a great opportunity, and I've had people come see me from the show, and they say, "Wow, your show is doom and gloom." Well, we try to say it's reality, and you know, perception is reality. The only thing is, and I say it here on the show, unless you're delusional, and anybody who looks at what's going on in the world that doesn't see there's a problem is totally blind. They're just not looking. They're just not looking at what's going on in the world and in America today. And, you know, we have so much uncertainty, and uncertainty drives the markets. And you got terrorism. You got countries that are – I mean, our country is spending money at a rate that is totally unacceptable to any financial person in the world, and we allow our politicians to stand up there and say, everything's fine. We have a great economy. When everybody knows, anybody who is logical at all knows the economy has sucked for the last 16 years. You know, and I talk about it on the show a lot. I think the stock market, that we know it, died at the turn of the century. It became a world economy, no longer an American economy. And I'm hearing now more and more people saying that, but we've been saying it for years. And I believe it's true. Well, listen, Greg, I hope that gets your answer, but I would get that book if I were you, and I'd read it, and that'll give you all the answers to your question. We're going to have to head out. Happy Father's Day to everybody. Carl, have a great Father's Day.
You too, Chuck.
Thanks for listening to Investing Simplified.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. How often do you have a checkup? Annually? Only when you're not feeling your best? Or are you one who waits until there is an emergency condition? High blood pressure, rapid pulse, or sleepless nights could be the result of your investment portfolio or no estate plan. But there is a specialist ready to offer you a checkup on your financial health.
Hey, Gene, Dr. Price. Paging Dr. Price.
Chuck Price, the financial doctor and author of Investing Simplified, is offering you a free financial checkup. Whether you're asking for a second opinion, a complete financial physical, or investment stress test, Chuck Price, the financial doctor, can help diagnose your money ailments and prescribe a prudent path towards healthy investments and peace of mind. Call 503-253-3000 to schedule your financial checkup or on the web at pfgwm.com. That's pfgwm.com. You'll feel better.